Hi, my name is Faden Papamichael. I'm the cinematographer of Ford versus Ferrari, and you're listening to the Go Creative Show.
Hey, everyone. My name is Ben Consoli. I am a director and owner of BC Media Productions. This is the Go Creative Show, the show dedicated to creative professionals and filmmakers. Today, we discuss the cinematography of Ford versus Ferrari with Faden Papamichael. The Go Creative Show is supported by Hedge, Shutterstock, Rule Boston Camera, and Premium Beat. Now, I have to confess something to you guys. This whole episode, of course, is about Ford versus Ferrari. And I saw it and I loved it, but it's not really one of those movies that's kind of my type of movie. It's not something that I would see the trailer for and say, I need to be there on opening night. There's nothing in the world that will keep me away from this. So I went into it with, I was expecting a good film, of course. I was expecting a well-acted film. I was absolutely blown away by this thing. Blown away. Particularly because the cinematography is just so stunning, especially when you realize that most of it, almost all of it, was done practically. You know, you're watching it and you're thinking to yourself, wow, that is some really good visual effects. Then you realize, yeah, it looks so good because it's real. And that's the thing that's so stunning to me. And we get to the bottom of all of that with Faden in just a few minutes. But wow, there is so much to get to. And it's amazing what he and his team has been able to do practically with Ford versus Ferrari. It is stunning. In other news, we are fast approaching our 200th episode. I can't believe it. 200 episodes of this thing. And we're trying to figure out what to do. Do we have a big celebration? I don't know. I really don't know what to do. I'd love your suggestions. We're considering maybe doing a live show in New York City. Let us know. It would be really, really fun, but we want to know that you guys are into it. So find us on social media, Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, and just let us know if you would like Go Creative Show to come to New York and do a live show. To celebrate our 200th episode, or just for whatever reason. Doesn't matter what the episode number is, just to get out there. And while you're on those platforms, please do follow us, because when we have upcoming guests, we let you guys know so that you can ask your questions, and then we'll ask them on the show. I think we do a few audience questions in today's episode as well, so stay tuned for that. So before we get to our interview with Faden, I want to talk about Hedge. Hedge is a backup software for filmmakers that is going to change your life. It is. I know it's super dramatic, but here's the thing. Before Hedge, I was just dragging my media files all over my Finder. There was no real rhyme or reason to it. And yes, you can make copies that way, but it's not really the professional way to do it. You know, you don't get alerts when the media is transferred. You can't import multiple sources, send it to multiple destinations, all the things that make Hedge so great. You know, I no longer use the Finder for my media management, and thankfully I don't, because of Hedge. This is what it is, okay? It's a backup software for filmmakers, and the way I use it is this. When I'm on set and I'm responsible for managing and backing up all the media, you know, I have cards from my camera operators and my audio techs and a behind-the-scenes videographer and photographer, and there's just media cards all over the place. So I can take them all, I import them right into Hedge. They're all in one column on the left-hand side. And then I set my destinations, which for me are two backups. So I can have a double backup. I press transfer and it just goes. It's done. It's fast. It's reliable. Everything is being done correctly, the right way. And because I have Hedge Connect on my phone, I get a notification when the transfer is done. It is everything that I want in a backup software. And they're constantly updating this thing, constantly. So when you get the full license, you can get a 20% off discount by using Go Creative Show in the coupon code. But there are a whole bunch of other licenses available. So I encourage you, just go and play with it and check it out for yourself at hedge.video/GoCreativeShow. Your media is important. Treat it professionally. Treat it with love. That's what you get with hedge.video/GoCreativeShow. hedge.video/GoCreativeShow. All right. Let's dive into our interview, because there's so much to talk about, so much to learn with the cinematographer of Ford versus Ferrari, Faden Papamichael. So I'm here with Faden Papamichael, the cinematographer for Ford v. Ferrari. I saw it just a couple days ago. It's absolutely fantastic, and I'm so glad to have you on.
Thank you, Ben. Pleasure to be on, and excited about this movie finally coming out.
One of the things that was so surprising to me was how much was practical. I mean, I think in this day and age, you just expect a certain level of CG, and to hear that you guys really tried to not do that and tried to do everything practical as much as you can. Was that decision made by you solely, or is that something that also came from the director of the studio? Like, where did this decision come from and why?
I mean, it's 1966, you know, really didn't want it to feel artificial. And no, that's a decision that didn't come from me. I mean, it was certainly something in the works. I don't know. We decided to build these cars. You know, the original cars that we're portraying in the film are, you know, cost between $15 and $40 million. So, you know, first hurdle was, how do we get these cars? Even if the people that own those cars would be willing to lend them to us, we certainly wouldn't be able and allowed to, you know, abuse them and drive them at the speeds we wanted. I mean, we did want to convey, get close to race speeds, actual race speeds, which, you know, turns out to be impossible unless you are Steve McQueen and you actually kept the actual race cars. And, you know, he continued shooting at Le Mans. But, you know, we had to build the cars, which were still expensive. We built over 30 cars. We had to pre-design at least, you know, the 24-hour sequence, the Le Mans sequence was pre-vised. I mean, you have to, just because you have to figure out how many cars you need, you know, how to break it down. I mean, just for cost. And it's not even that it's going to be a lot of CG. You still have to, you know, figure out how to do this stuff. And of course, you know, what shots do you need? Ken Miles, what shots do you need? I mean, Christian Bale to actually be in, and how do you design the action so we see it from with him tied into it, which was very important to us. In particular, you know, because it's an open car, the Cobra Shelby in the opening race in Willow Springs, I mean, you really see all the surrounding vehicles, you know, because he's not in an enclosed cockpit. So,
yeah.
We discovered that's just, you know, the most spectacular things is just mount these cameras. We put four cameras on, you know, profile, three-quarter, frontal on Christian Bale and send him off. And all the cars that he's interacting with are all real. They're all, you know, inches away from each other, going around these turns in the desert. And when you see a car spin off in the back and go up in a big dust cloud or a fireball, I mean, that's all real mechanical effects driven by precision drivers. We had, you know, actual race car drivers. We had stunt drivers, you know, amazing pursuit vehicle drivers. Robert Nagel, a stunt coordinator, you know, really understood what Mangold was after, which was, you know, do as much of it as possible. And a lot of that came through the testing when we just went out onto this airstrip in Acqua Dolce, where we ended up building this entire set, you know, which are all this, the starting finish line and all the pits of Le Mans that was built on a little airstrip just north off the 14, north of Los Angeles. But we used that for testing rigs initially, you know, before we decided how we're going to approach it technically. And just quickly discovered, you know, the closer you are to them, the lower you are to the ground, the, you know, you tie in some asphalt swooshing by, that's the most spectacular way to show it. So,
let me just take a quick step back, because I want to talk about your pre-vis process for this. I'm assuming you had, well, why don't you tell me, what was your previous process for us? What were you using to kind of create it? Was it like a full 3D design of the track and the set, and you were just basically moving cameras through it? How was it going?
you know, we start with a storyboard, and not all of it is pre-vised. It's sort of it's not that that elaborate of a process. I mean, they have all the cars built. They have the sort of the actual track, so we know when they're going down, let's say, the Malzahn Strait, and then, you know, you end up at the right hairpin turn of that. So, I mean, they're very specific beats. You know, it's you want to be able to track all the beats through that 24-hour storyline, and yeah, that's very important to us. So you do create the track, you do create the cars. It's something that, originates with storyboards. The editor, Mike McCusker, is very involved. Jim is very involved. And although we typically, Mangold and I, you know, this is our fifth collaboration, I mean, we're not people who really work off a storyboard. I mean, every once in a while, we'll generate one or even a shot list, when we doing all our dramatic scenes, we really don't work off of that. And we're more in tune in trying to, you know, find a moment, see what the actors are doing, seeing their behavior. I mean, there's just to sidetrack for a second. I mean, there's that scene where Tracy lets, I mean, when Matt comes back and he has to explain himself why they failed in the previous year. And he's like, the deuce, Henry Ford II goes, you know, tell me why I shouldn't fire everyone yeah, involved. And he, you know, he's very still in the chair and he's just never looks at Matt. He just sits and maintains his profile, never makes eye contact. And, you know, us seeing that makes us design and decide how we can play this here. You know, it makes us find the angles. This is something you really can't, you know, preconceived months before, and there's a lot of it is taking advantage of what the actors do for us. I mean, on Walk the Line, we never really knew what Joaquin is going to be doing exactly on stage, so we like to be reactive.
Well, was it challenging for you? Because the impression that I get, obviously talking to you, but even in preparing for the interview beforehand, is that you and James Mangold don't really follow storyboards so much. Like you're more about the actors, you're more about the organic thing that's happening in that moment. But now having to do this level of, you know, driving scenes and action sequences, was it kind of a hindrance to have to be a little bit more strict?
It was really only applied to the 24-hour race sequence, because in addition to our unit, which, you know, included the whole start and finish, all the pits, and of course all the work with the actors, there was the second unit that did, you know, a lot of the car-to-car stuff that had to tie in directly to our beats, our story beats, you know, and we're talking about, you know, a complicated timeline also, because the race starts at 4 p.m. and we're playing that as a sunny afternoon, and then towards the evening and dusk, storm clouds are coming. Yeah. We got the night sequence with the rain, and then we got dawn in the morning, and then we, you know, go back to day, overcast, and then sun again for the end. You know, and tracking all that and keeping that all the second unit footage that was coming in from Georgia. You know, they were on country roads in Georgia because, you know, Le Mans is an actual country race. It's not on a track. It's, you know, cross country, countryside, France. So they had to find, you know, we scouted that landscape in Georgia around Atlanta and Savannah, and also used some in two tracks down there. But it was hard coordinating all that. So that was a bit restrictive for the way we normally like to operate. I mean, there's race scenes in this film where we're, you know, same as we do with the actors, we're kind of finding things and go, oh my God, that looks cool. Like, you know, let's hold on that. Or, in the sequence when Ken Miles drives, we see him drive in the desert towards the end. The last time we see him drive is, that was very much improvised. I mean, at that point, that was towards the end of the schedule. And we kind of knew what we can do and what our tools can do. And we literally jumped in the car and in this pursuit car, and I had a camera mounted up front, and The reason it's you know, it's a little bit of a more poetic, cinematic moment, because the sounds fade away and Matt Damon's voiceover comes in and talks about, you know, it's 7,000 RPMs and that's when your body becomes weightless and it has another layer to it. And the visuals are very important. But we kind of, as we're losing, you know, we're out in the desert on this Honda test track in Mojave, and we have like, let's say 15, 20 minutes before the sun disappears behind the mountain. And I'm like, okay, let's jump in the car. Like, we got to get out there. Get one round at least with this, you know, pursuing the new, it's the new GT prototype that they're developing for the following year. And I'm like, okay, good. We're clean here. We're moving. Okay, have a car pull in front of us. Okay, now slow down. Let it disappear behind the mole. I mean, it's almost, you know, I mean, that rarely happens, I think, where you're actually on the fly designing sort of these shots, these driving shots. But it's, you know, of course, a single car, and it worked out very nicely. And at the same time, because of our time restrictions, we had a camera mounted inside that was getting a close-up of Christian Bale and the matched, you know, the flares. And I don't know if you recall that scene, but it has all these, you know, this very bathed in golden light. And
oh, yeah.
You know, we ran back. We had a camera waiting on a long lens, you know, for Noah's POV, his son's POV, and then just literally like a minute before the sun disappeared, we got that shot where he's coming over the hill, and you know, big dust cloud goes up. Anyway, it just it was very similar. Actually, in 310 to Yuma, we did the very last shot with the train pulling away. Under similar rush conditions, and then turned out to be one of the nicest shots. It's the sun was so low that it came underneath the train, and as it's pulling out, it's the wheels and the under barrels of the wagons would cast this, you know, it was this kinetic light on them, playing on the kid as the train pulls out. And again, you know, it was like 3 minutes later, we would have not had that. So, you know, sometimes.
I can hear in your voice. Yeah, I can hear in your voice that you just love it when like the stars align, everything works out. You love. It sounds like you love putting yourself in these challenges and overcoming them. It just. I can hear it. I
mean, we don't like the stress part, but when it works when it works out, it's great, and that's what you know. That's what cinema is, and you find these moments, and you have to kind of just be there and catch them. I mean, that's what our that's what we're there for. I mean, and Mangold and I mean, we do have a very similar taste and very similar film language. So there's not a lot of arguing about what is the shot. It's like we see it. We're very much in sync. You know, our instructions to the operators are always, you know, we like little push-ins. We're very much about the speed and of those little slider moves and rotations. And we're very much in sync. But it is, you know, let the actors... or let things happen, and then, you know, but you have to be able to identify them and not miss them and take advantage of that. And that's very much how I do enjoy operating and not, you know, there's obviously, you know, you read the script, you visualize it in your head. I mean, you talk to the production designer about colors and palettes and textures, and you get everything, you know, close, but then, really, even for lighting, I mean, my approach to lighting really, you know, I form it. I mean, that decision, how I'm going to do something, I pretty much form on the day when I see everything set, when I see the actors moving in the space, when I see the rehearsal, you know, what are the dynamics, how they're playing it. And, you know, that's what I get inspired by. And I go, okay, well, this seems like it should be like this, you know, and I didn't realize he's going to be doing that. And it might be nice if he steps into the, out of a light here, or you know, his silhouette here. I mean, but those are things you know you can design and you can preconceive. But I think when you strictly hold yourself to that, what you designed and created in prep, then you miss a lot of opportunities. A lot of, you know, finding these little moments. And the directors I enjoy working with pretty much all have that approach. I mean, I've worked. You know, I've done over 40 features, so every movie is different. And I've worked with great technical directors who really understand lensing and camera and, you know, post-production, color DIs, all of that. You watch those films and you go, great craftsmanship, but I don't really, I don't really connect to these characters here. I'm not emotionally involved, and happens to me, I think to many people. And, the best is when you have a combination of a good storyteller, a good creator of characters. I mean, Mangold is not just, a writer, a very strong actor's director. He's very good in fine-tuning also in the last moment with slight adjustments and comments to the actors, even sometimes while we're rolling, but very precise, finding these beats that make it work. But in addition to that, he's just also very good with camera. I mean, he's a still photographer himself. He works on his stills with his color correction. He's very much a complete filmmaker in that sense. And that's very enjoyable, because often you get somebody who's a writer and, doesn't really know what the camera is doing and doesn't really know how the visuals can help the story, support the writing. Jim is really well, well balanced in that sense.
You've worked with him a lot. I mean,
it's partially because we both come, we're both working in the Hollywood system on a high level now in the studio system. But I consider myself more of from European cinema. I grew up in Europe, but we're about the same generation. We're, the same age. So our influences are very similar. We like, Japanese films, Italian neorealism, French New Wave, classics from Westerns from the, 40s, 50s. I mean, so we have a similar background, and he's a Cal Arts guy, actually. His first movie was Heavy. I mean, he was one in Sundance. I mean, I think of him more as an indie filmmaker who somehow managed to, function in Hollywood at this high level. And is, again, just like this movie is a rare exception that we're making these kind of films that are not for teenagers and at this budget level. So is Mangold. He's kind of an exceptional filmmaker to be able to combine those elements. And my background is independent film. I mean, I started Roger Corman and, did for decades, like low budget movies. So I didn't come up through the studio system either.
Hmm. Can we spend a few minutes talking about the car itself, that pod car that we're talking about, and how you structured the camera setup and how it actually works? I think a lot of people don't really know, myself included, until I've started doing research about it, how you actually shoot these chase sequences and these, race sequences in this case. Can you talk to us a little bit about that? The structure of the car, where the cameras are, and who's driving it?
Right. Well, the pod car is one of the tools we use. There's also Biscuit, which is similar. But let's start with the pod car. So the pod car is the actual race car, the picture car, like all the other cars we build. It does have an extended frame, a chassis. It's a bit longer, so it enables us to put a pod on it. That's why it's called the pod car. Now the pod is basically a cabin. In this case, it's just out of pipe and it has a steering wheel, and it sits on the car. You can mount it in the back or in the front. It can be re-rigged. But the race car actually sits on its own wheels. It's not on a trailer. That's what the Biscuit rig is. It's like a very low profile trailer, basically, that also can drive. But then the picture car that the actor sits in is not on its own wheels. The pod car, what makes it so great, and especially for this film, is you put the actors in it. They're sitting in the actual car that's actually touching the ground on its own tires. And you send it off with this precision driver, Alan Bitford, in this case, our pod car and camera car driver, being able to get up to high speeds. And the actors who are sitting in the cockpit are really experiencing everything the way they would if they were driving the car. All the vibrations, the sounds, the wind, you know, the G forces, which is really great. I mean, Christian, of course, being, you know, fantastic actor and can create any situation, make it believable. But it's that, trust me, it's helpful even to him when you're not, you know, you're not on stage with some LED panels creating the background and, you know, there's a hydraulic rig or grip shaking the car and the fan blowing on you. I mean, when you're being whipped around those tracks and experiencing the G's, and that certainly helps anybody's performance. And you know, he would also do amazing things. We would literally, you know, mount these cameras, like I said earlier, like in Grand Prix, just hard mount these cameras, have a series of close-ups at the same time and just send them off. And, you know, we didn't really know what he's going to be doing. I mean, he would start singing, talking to himself. Like the first time we were like, you know, because we're watching on a monitor, sometimes we're in a pursuit vehicle so we can stay close in terms of our transmission for the video. But, you know, we're like, is he saying something? What is he doing? You know, he's like, oh, he's singing. Or, you know, and it was great. It's very much, you know, let him experience the thing and then let us just sort of capture what's happening. And Willow Springs, I mean, we saw, you know, him with his goggles and the dirt on his face, but then seeing all the cars around it. I mean, that car is being driven around the track and all the other cars are free driving. And you know, he starts talking to the other, you know, other drivers, although, you know, they can't really hear him, but it's, you know, he really embraced that method of shooting. And then it's, you're actually going around the track like multiple times. It's not like, okay, we're doing this little piece here where, you know, he pulls up next to Gurney and he looks over. It's like, no, let's go around the track. Okay, let's go around the track again. Let's, you know, we have Alexa LF, so, you know, they can run for quite a while. And we're just, you know, collecting all, you know, all kinds of moments and materials that, you know, it's just unfold themselves as you know, even when we're resetting and the cars are going back to one, we would never cut. There'd be all kinds of little shots that we would, you know, be able to pick up on the way.
How many cameras did you have mounted?
You know, in Willow Springs, we had four because it was, you know, the Cobra, Shelby Cobra, which was open. I was able to get an array of four cameras around him. Then when we're looking forward, have like an over and then clean POVs. I mean, I really find the POVs out the windshield to be very effective.
Yeah.
Tell the story, you know, again, like keep our main character as the center of everything that's happening. So, especially in the 24-hour race in Le Mans, a lot of POVs in the mirror, close-ups of Christian and, you know, profiles that we see of the cars, side by side. And, also in the, Daytona sequences, you know, that's actually, the one race that's more like on a NASCAR track. So there was a lot of side-by-side action we could create there. And yeah, but, you know, three to four cameras, sometimes a camera low almost on the seat next to him, raking up at him. We would try and squeeze him in because it was, you know, so fruitful, just sending him off and getting all these things. And also capturing all the real interactive light, because we would send them off often in low in the afternoon when the sun would be low, which really makes the sun play across their chest and face. And when the sun is lower, or in Daytona, when the lights from the track would come and flare across the faces, and it's great. Yeah.
You are listening to the Premium Beat Song of the Week. It's called Be Big by Reactor Productions. PremiumBeat.com is where to go for all of your royalty-free music. When you go to PremiumBeat.com, you access a collection of thousands of royalty-free tracks for as low as $49 each. And most of the time, you don't just get the individual song. You get cutdowns, you get loop sets, you get stems, so you can customize the track to fit your project perfectly. But it's all about quality, and PremiumBeat.com certainly has that. So check it out for yourself over at premiumbeat.com. And there's still so much more to talk about with Faden, but before we get there, let's talk about Shutterstock. You know, Shutterstock.com has over 270 million images, over 16 million video. Many of them are in 4K. And really, when you think about it, it can be a little overwhelming to find what you're looking for. But Shutterstock is so committed to making sure that the user experience is the best that it can possibly be. They've completely changed their new homepage for account holders. So they launched a brand new, upgraded, intelligent homepage that's going to enhance your ability to find the perfect image. The discovery process is super important, right? And Shutterstock knows this, and they're always striving to make it better. And these are three areas on the new homepage that they really enhanced. First, personalization. So your homepage is just for you. Second, a monthly curated collection that's based on your buying habits. And an improved interaction with your account history. So it takes into account what you've purchased and uses their little fancy algorithms to figure out exactly what is going to be appealing to you and serves it right up on the homepage. It's amazing. And it's a great starting point for your search with Shutterstock. So that's just one of the many things that Shutterstock.com has going for them at the site. The blog is amazing. They have a whole bunch of tools. They've got the elements that I've been talking to you guys about, but this is a big one. So what you need to do, though, is have an account with Shutterstock. So go to Shutterstock.com, set up an account if you don't have one, and just enjoy the brand new intelligent homepage. You guys are going to love it. All right, let's get back to our interview with Faden Papamichael, the director of photography for Ford versus Ferrari. I want to talk about the speed that you are moving the car. It sounds like, just based on our previous conversation and stuff that I've been reading too, is that you went a little bit faster than you normally would, or that is, you know, of practice in cinematography for, you know, race scenes and chase scenes. Is that true? And if so, how does it compare the speed that you guys shot in versus the you know, typical traditional speed for action sequences like this?
Well, there's no typical traditional speed for action sequences, but the bottom line is we wanted to go as fast as possible. And yeah. Like I mentioned before, Steve McQueen, they were doing in Le Mans, they were doing in the film Le Mans, they were doing, I mean, it's in the 70s, and they actually had the actual race cars. They were doing 200 miles an hour with cameras mounted to them. It was very dangerous at the time. And we couldn't do that. You know, we also have Christian Bale wear a period correct helmet, you know, which is only rated up to speeds for a certain amount of speed. So whenever Christian's in the car driving on the close-ups, you know, we were restricted as fast up to a certain speed. You know, then you have to switch to a helmet that looks similar, but is a little bit bulkier. There's all kinds of things, you know, we didn't really know in advance. And as Robert Nagel, our stunt coordinator, kept reminding us, because we're like, gotta go faster, we gotta go faster. It's like, guys, these are not actual race cars. You know, these are picture cars you build. I mean, it's, I mean, they're very, you know, they're very good. They can go fast, but they can't really go, you know, what the actual Ford GTs were doing. I mean, in 66, those cars were doing to getting over 200 miles an hour on the Mulsanne Straight. And you know, you can't build a car in a few months and expect it to perform like that, like we had to do. And we had to do that because we needed 30 cars. We needed to crash them. We needed to, you know, really, you know, abuse them and drive them hard. And but there's many issues. I mean, to fine tune a chassis to actually be able to perform like a race car, it's an art. It takes time. And then, you know, the tire combination, and then, you know, we have the rain sequence. So then it's like, well, we can't go fast in the rain. We need these special rain tires. I'm like, well, let's get them. But, you know, but it's complicated. But we did achieve great speeds. I mean, I think as you see the film, I mean, you'll never feel like, oh, you know, that doesn't really play fast in
LA. Oh my God, it feels incredibly fast.
Yeah, I mean, it's aided by the sound design. And
of course.
And Mangold loves playing things loud. I mean, in 310 to Yuma, we really played the gunshots loud too. I mean, that's always great. And I really didn't want to undercrank. I mean, of course you can undercrank the camera and you know, but it's not much you can do. Then, you know, it starts looking, I mean, you start feeling it. So I really was hoping we never had to do that. I think there's maybe a handful of shots where Mike McCusker did do that in post, but luckily we could avoid that situation for most situations. And, I remember going chasing the Cobra around on Willow Springs, and there's a low shot as he approaches the finish, and the white Shelby Cobra sort of dips into the dirt on the last turn before he wins that race. And I was following in a Porsche Cayenne, pulling the iris. I mean, we had to, the assistants and camera operators often had to, following these cars, and we had to stay close, where, you have these traditional pursuit vehicles normally. They're like, hyped up SUVs like Porsche Cayennes or AMG Mercedeses. But it was hard to keep up with them. You are on the limit. I mean, we would go into these turns, 90 miles an hour, these wide turns at Willow Springs. And I drive sports cars, man. I enjoy driving fast. I've driven go-karts on tracks. But you're right on the limit. I mean, we certainly maxed out what we could do with, our cars and our pursuit vehicles. So we even had to build what we called, so we had the Frankenstein, we had the pod car, we had a Biscuit, which is also driven by precision driver, but the car sits on a very low trailer. And then we had to build a camera car specifically for this film. We called it the Frankenstein car.
Why is that?
And well, because it's pieced together out of, it's basically like the frame and the chassis of one of our Ford GT40s, but it's all, pipes and little camera plateaus and platforms, so we could rig cameras very low to the ground and really track and pursue these cars inches, tracking them on the tailpipe and having them swoosh in front of camera and keep up with them in the turns. And that's no conventional car really could do that. So it had to be a car that performed exactly the same as our picture cars. So it was great. And we never lost the camera, really. I mean, I think we clipped a map box once.
Wow. That's an achievement right there. I figured cameras were going to be falling off and getting broken the whole time.
Yeah, surprisingly enough, we didn't lose any camera gear. I mean, cars, there were a few little crashes, little fender benders, because they, you see it in the film. I mean, they're going 100 miles an hour and, 2 inches separate the wheel to wheel. And then the third one with a camera mounted to it, that's, a foot behind those two cars that are almost touching. And, so that was Igor Meglic, second unit DP, and Daryl that... did a lot of that car-to-car stuff out in Georgia, and that was, quite something.
Can you talk to us about the way you achieved the rain, how you created the rain, and how you shot around it?
Well, yeah, I mean, so we go, okay, well, we got this whole night rain sequence. I mean, typically you said rain towers or condors that have rain dispensers on them, but we go, well, these cars, they cover, 100 yards in 1 second when they're going at speeds. So he obviously can't afford or can't attempt to rain that whole the track. So we did some tests, and we started with sending a water truck ahead and getting a wet down, and then I had the idea of let's send off a truck that sprays, off the back of it that has a water tank on it and pre-sprays. But that truck with a water tank on it can't go very fast.
Pre-spraying the ground you're talking about, or pre-spraying like the car?
Also spraying, you know, into the atmosphere as we're moving, just to keep something up in the air. But that car had to be sent off so much ahead of time. It's not like you have another race car with a water tank on it.
So
that had to be sent up because our cars would, you know, otherwise our cars would catch up with it within, you know, seconds.
So yeah.
It became kind of ineffective, but we still did it. And then we went.
So that is how you did it.
Yeah. And then, I mean, then really what we found, of course, by having our camera car that was, let's say, a Frankenstein rig or another pursuit car, leading ahead, just the spray from what you're picking up off the ground from the tires of the other vehicles created most of that. And then, creating these headlights, and I chose yellow lights for the Ferraris and white, sort of these off-white lights for the Fords. You know, it was nice to, you know, identify them at night just kind of from the color of the lights. And then the spray on the headlight beams, you know, became really, you know, beautiful. And and you really read the rain a lot from that. But most of it was spray off the ground, really, from the tires of other vehicles. And then there are certain shots of, as you know, VFX did help augment the rain on those sequences. Mm-hmm. Although in the dailies and in the tests, you know, we were like, oh my God, this looks so good and so much better than we expected it to look without being able to put rain towers. So, but, you know, we did get some help from VFX as well. But they had a good base to start with, a really good base.
Can you talk to us a little bit about your lighting approach for this film? I mean, I'm assuming that you're using a lot of natural light, but what else is there to supplement?
When you do a big day exterior movie like this, it's all about planning the day. When we build the pits in Agua Dulce, you know, there had to be, the orientation of the set was dictated by the runway. Because we use the runway basically as a start-finish straightaway. So it wasn't in a perfect position for us, but we made the best use out of it that we could, because basically the sun would rise behind our set. So that means in the morning hours, I would be in shade, and I would take advantage of that and play whatever sequences required dusk or dawn looks. Before I got hit by direct sunlight. Being in California, you can pretty much count on every day the sun coming around eventually. Really had to just lay it out. And Adam Somner, our first assistant director, was very helpful in scheduling certain scenes. You know, I go up to 11, we can do V scenes. And then at 11:30, we start getting hit and, you know, let's do an hour of looking this way, and then let's break for lunch. And when we come back from lunch, we're going to have the sun frontal on our set, and then it sets over here. So, you know, you see a lot of those late sunset shots, especially, you know, the start and finish, which are 4 p.m. in the afternoon in the story. So it kind of worked where the sun is low, and, you know, you get all this beautiful, natural late afternoon light. And I mean, a lot of people are talking, how did you get all these, you know, golden hour shots in these?
Well, it is a big thing. I mean,
it's mostly because we were, you know, always kind of waiting for that sun to come around. And then we were rushing and had to squeeze in as much as we could into those time periods. And same, you know, with that scene I described earlier, the final scene, not the final scene, but when we see Ken Miles drive the last time in the desert, I mean, it's all like, we only have one day to do it, and we got to do these shots, and then we got to get this driving stuff at the end of the day as quickly as possible. But often, you know, you maneuver through the day, you make a plan. I mean, that's what the exterior cinematography is all about. It's you know, I don't light it electrically. I use some negatives and, you know, big blacks and or bounces, but it's all about, you know, figuring out. Making the decisions, you know, you're going to do this wide shot at this time. You're going to start with close-ups while you can control it. Then, you know, at 4 o'clock, we're going to fall back to these camera positions, do this wide shot. And, you know, you have a plan and you hopefully, you know, nothing happens along the way during that day. And you're able to stick to that timetable. And when it works, it's great. But there's another situation where Christian Bale and his son, you know, played by Noah, you know, walk out onto the airfield. And it's in the trailer, and I'm sure you know, when they talk about the, you know, the perfect lap, and it's all shot in magic hour in dusk after, you know, I want it to start rolling after the sun sets and complete it before it's completely nighttime. And that, you know, as most people know, that's a pretty narrow window. I mean, in our case,
yes,
it was, you know, I mean, probably 20 minutes of actual shooting time, because we're out at Ontario Airport, which is standing in for LAX, which is where Shelby actually tested all these cars. They would use a runway at LAX and wait for the last flight to leave and use the runways to test the prototypes. But that scene was, you know, we wanted it to be, so we're on an actual airport, functioning airport, and there's, you know, big planes coming in on the one runway over, and we couldn't set up, you know, your typical equipment that you would use in a thing, in a scene like this, like big bounces or frames, because the airport staff said that might get picked up by the wind. It could fly into oncoming air traffic. Couldn't really use any lights because it might mislead or pilots.
I can't believe it was a functioning airport while you were shooting it. That's insane.
And it's literally like they go, you can only go up to this point here, because we also didn't know the blocking. I mean, we knew that, you know, Ken and the son are going to pull up in this Ford GT, start walking, strolling down the runway, you know, philosophizing about racing and the track, and at some point probably sit down on the tarmac. So I got a, you know, I got an Oculus head mounted onto my conventional Fisher dolly, and because I go, we can't lay track, you know, there's no way. I mean, we have to just be able to roll anywhere. So I got a stabilized head, and we just rolled on the ground. I had a second camera with Scott Sakamoto, my Steadicam operator, so he was kind of ready to, you know, be reactive and see what happens. And you know, you have a child actor, and you know, Christian Bale is helpful, and Noah is very professional, but you know, it's was quite a long dialogue scene and motion, and we needed reverses, we needed to look the direction they're looking at and talking about, and we had art department had brought these numbers, you know, we had one big number 8 sign, and I go, okay, well, that is my only light source. I mean, I have to, you know, motivate off of that. Luckily, it was large and lit up, you know, white. So I put one light to motivate, to duplicate that effect. You know, a 360 sky panel, which is the LED panel. And, you know, you start, let's say you start the scene at 7 p.m. and the sun has just set and you're at a 8 stop, or, you know, you're ending, filtering down, and the light is at 90%. And then by the time you finish the scene 20 minutes later, the light output is at like 3%. I mean, we couldn't even like knock it down anymore, because, you know, you're opening up the stop, you're pushing, starting to push the, you know, ISO and the opening up the exposure. And then all these aircraft landing lights that are little blue dots that you see in distant runways are starting to become brighter and brighter and gloom more, because, you know, I can't control all those lights in the distance, of course. So
yeah,
they're tricky and they're challenging. And, you know, we're certainly scrambling and, you know, had the possibility, I guess, to come back the next day to complete it. But it was such a nice little intimate scene. And we were like, really don't want to come back. Let's just get it done. And you know, by the time we got the last shot, I mean, to the eye, it was like complete. Night. And then, you know, Mangold and I were talking. I go, I think we got it. I think it's good enough. You know, we don't have to reshoot this. And then with a little help in the DI and the digital intermediate and with Skype and with Skip Kimball and my colorist, we balanced it all out and reined it in. And then Olivier from our VFX supervisor was able to, in the earlier portions of that scene, to give a little glow to the lights to, you know, approximate what they would look like later in the scene. So, you know, it's great, but it's again, you're planning these things, you go for it, and, you know, sometimes you need to get a bit lucky, But it's great when you accomplish it, when you sort of have this plan and actually you've managed to pull it off, you know. It's fun in filmmaking when it's not all just mechanical. I mean, that's why I really don't enjoy being on stages and in studios a lot so long. I mean, it's nice.
You don't.
Well, this movie is all locations. We never were on stage. I mean, we have, of course, we do have, a few very specific close-ups we did for Ken Miles against some green. Like, when he decides to downshift and wait and like really specific internal moments that when we're just driving around and stuff, we try to get him. But, we wanted to really nail those. And we have 2 days. Not even on a stage in one of the aircraft hangars, like a little, just close-ups of Ken Miles and that we did on stage. But what happens on location and is just, things happen. I mean, you sometimes it's, of course, compromised and more difficult, but very often, I mean, the results are just so much better because, I mean, it's just the real thing and there's, real things happen and, to me, it's much more inspiring. I mean, Walk the Line had 100 locations that we had to shoot in 48 days. This one had probably 100 locations. We didn't have that many shooting days, I think 63, which is not a lot for a movie like this. So, yeah.
Yeah, that's a pretty low number, especially for how many locations, my God.
Yeah, yeah.
And there is still so much to talk about with Faden, but we have one more message I want to get to you guys. And this one is about Rule Boston Camera. Yes, Rule is the place to go to purchase and rent all of your production equipment for a couple of reasons. One, they have a gigantic inventory. It's insanity. They've been in business for over 35 years, nearly 40 now. And when the big movies come to town, the big commercials come to town here in Boston, they use Rule. So if it's good enough for them, it's good enough for me, it's good enough for all of us. So they've got you covered. Whatever equipment you need, you have it. But in addition to that, they have amazing and attentive service. They want to be your production partner. They really do. They're going to give you expert advice and counsel in pre-production. They're going to give you technical guidance when you take the equipment out for your shoot. And they're committed to supporting you while you're on location the whole time. So we're talking about peace of mind, world-class inventory, amazing service. They have the whole package, and it's right there at Rule Boston Camera at rule.com, RULE.com. All right, let's get to the conclusion of our interview with Faden Papamichael, the director of photography for Ford versus Ferrari. We've got a couple of questions from our audience just to wrap up in the last couple of minutes. DC Side Media on Instagram is asking about the best camera op you've worked with. This is a topic that comes up quite a bit from our listeners. They want to know about the relationship between DPs and their camera ops. And I'd love to hear yours. I mean, who's the best you've worked with? And then also, what is that relationship like?
It's key. I mean, I come from indie and low budget filmmaking, so I grew up operating myself all the time, and it was a very hard transition once I started working on studio pictures. Once I got into the union, it was very hard for me to make that adjustment because again, when you're the DP and operating yourself, you can be very instinctive. You can make decisions that, an operator that executes for you or executes the discussed shot for you cannot really make unless they're truly great. And I'm lucky to have, two wonderful operators that I work with on this, David Luckenbach, who has done all, I mean, I've done all the Mangold movies with exception of Wolverine, but has worked with Mangold. So the director has a good communication with the operator. In this case, I mean, Jim is very involved in the shots. And even while we're rolling, we give him instructions that were these little, the HMEs, they're little headsets that have a mic to the operators. And Because we come up with things a lot during the take. You know, we see, like I said earlier, we see somebody do something. I'm like, push in, rotate left, you know, boom down, you know.
Yeah.
And it can be annoying to the operators, but, you know, they're used to it. But David Luckenbach is somebody. And then, of course, I work a lot with Scott Sakamoto, who's, you know, a legendary Hollywood camera operator. I mean, started as an assistant with Haskell Wexler, but I've worked with him on Descendants, Ides of March, Monuments Men. I mean, he also did The Revenant and, you know, countless movies. Just amazing, talented, amazing eye composition. Can do steady cams that look exactly like dolly shots if you want that. And really just, I mean, that's one thing is the actual operating skill. The other thing is, you know, knowing how to run a set, how to, you know, communicate with the actors. I mean, how to make the, you know, we never want to burden the actors with too many technicalities. How to have them, you know, step on the mark, how to have them catch a light, or, you know, it's that whole, and that just takes a lot of experience. And it's really an art form to be a great A camera operator in Hollywood. I mean, often, you know, when I travel Europe, and they don't really have that tradition. So you see, you know, you have good operators, but they really don't know how to run a set. And it's just something that comes here. You know, we have generations and generations of this tradition, and Scott and David, I mean, they've been, you know, exposed to so many, you know, movie stars, and just even working with the art, with the set dressing, all that I think falls into, you know, start moving, you know, vehicles in the back, trucks, whatever you might catch, cones, you know, it's all these things that having a great operator is so useful. And then when you get used to having the best, it can be quite difficult. Yeah, love not working with operators. But I love operating myself also. And, you know, when I travel in Europe and I do non-union things, and I really enjoy jumping back on the camera.
Gorb420 on Instagram asks if Grand Prix was a source of inspiration. You've already said yes, so that one...
Absolutely. I mean, Grand Prix was probably the single... I mean, it wasn't even like we watched it specifically... Because with Mangold, we don't really sit down and look at other movies and, you know, to analyze them. I mean, but it was happened to be running, you know, in the office. There was a big OLED TV monitor. And Grand Prix was kind of just running on a loop, like nonstop. So, you know, while we're having lunch or, you know, talking about, you know, a budget meeting and stuff, I mean, I would, you know, I'm often bored in budget meetings. So.
How can you be? They're so thrilling, the conversations.
It's so exciting, yes. And so, you know, I would always just, like I saw, you know, would just look over at the, you know, monitor instead of the spreadsheet. And, you know, so we, and you know, Jim's seen it, I'm sure, multiple times. And but it was great, you know, just because every once in a while I would go, wow, look at that shot. It's so simple and so cool. Like, it's just... Look how long, you know, and the editor would be there, and I go, look how long they're holding on the shot, and so stuff like that, without really, like, you know, sitting down and getting too specific. Yeah.
That's cool. It's just on all the time. I like that.
Yeah.
That's cool. Well, he also asked another question about Cinerama and your thoughts on if it's going to make a comeback. What do you think? Do you have any thoughts on Cinerama?
No, I don't. I don't know, really. I mean, I even like IMAX, like this movie, my friend just said he saw it on IMAX. I always get concerned about that because for me, it's all about the frame and the correct aspect ratio. And I'm very much, you know, I come from still photography. So, you know, it's very important for me to have the actual frame and, you know, what my composition was. I mean, for me, composing to the exact frame is very important. So whenever there's new formats and new ways of viewing, I mean, I did some VR things that I didn't even have a frame. It was like 360, and I really didn't enjoy that. I mean, to me, then that's not really photography anymore. But I don't really know about Cinerama. I mean, can't really give an expert opinion on it. I just know when I tell my friends to go see this movie, I go, don't necessarily, you know, don't go see it. Just see it on a regular screen. Make sure it's a white screen, because the other problem is with the 3D theaters. You know, they have a silver screen, which really doesn't work so much for this because we have these old lenses and they vignette naturally, you know, the edges kind of fall off. And then on a silver screen, the center gets really hot or, you know, depending on where you sit. And so I'm kind of like, you know, more old school. I mean, wish we had film projection, you know, of course, this was generated large format Alexa with vintage anamorphics that were specifically expanded for this movie. And they have beautiful characteristics in terms of fall offs on the edges, vignetting, you know, the way the defocus, it's like a large format lens, the way it falls off the focus, but still maintains the characteristics of the anamorphic lens. And, you know, I really, you know, like projections and viewings that can show you all that without affecting it so much. Of course, there's the Dolby laser projection, which there are in many theaters in LA, but I know there's some which, you know, has a much brighter screen luminance, you know, 30-foot candles versus 14. And that's nice. And the blacks are really solid. That's a nice viewing experience. But yeah, Cinerama, I can't really, I don't know.
Sumatham_S on Instagram. We did cover this, so we don't need to dive into it again. He was wanted to know the challenges of shooting sequences at sunrise, sunset. I think we did a lot of that, so we've got that covered. Lastly, I mean, the last thing I just kind of want to get your thoughts on, because you've been pretty vocal about how old school filmmaking is really where you would like the industry to go. It's what certainly you've been doing. And I feel like in 2019, there's been some interesting shifts. I mean, once upon a time in Hollywood, you've worked with Joaquin Phoenix and Walk the Line. Of course, the Joker crossed the $1 billion line now. Your movie now, it's only been out for a couple of days, but there's certainly a lot of buzz about it. It's definitely going to be a big success in 2019. And I feel like, is there a shift going on, in your opinion, with filmmaking and you know, just the Hollywood studio structure? Like, is the success of these films, do you think this is something that's going to stick around and really impact filmmaking moving forward?
Well, I don't know if these two films are going to make cause a shift. I mean, we're certainly, you know, if Ford vs. Ferrari is successful at the box office domestically, I think internationally will be for sure. You know, it will, you know, as you know, Fox purchased Disney, and yeah. I mean,
Disney purchased, but close enough.
You know, and Disney, I mean, Fox would continue to maybe make some R-rated movies on a bigger budget level. You know, it will certainly encourage Disney and other studios to do that. It'll be good for all of us because sort of the adult dramas and movies that aren't really just targeted for teenagers or don't involve, you know, Marvel or superhero film figures in general. I mean, they are sparse and we don't get to see a lot of them anymore. They do still exist on a lower budget level, but those budgets are shrinking annually. They don't get wide releases, and you end up seeing them, if you're lucky, in a, you know, art house or, you know, on a plane or, so it's sad. I mean, I wish there was, you know, a balance. I mean, I'm not saying don't make, Marvel movies, don't make, VFX movies, don't make movies for kids and teenagers who go see things multiple times. I mean, I get it. It's the safest formula, and then, you know, we need our, it is a film industry, you know, we do need to be profitable and everyone needs to be able to continue to make movies. But it'd be nice if there was more balance and we could have more of these films you know, not windling them down to under $10 million budgets with very limited shooting days that have to only be able to shoot in Shreveport, Louisiana, or in, you know, and I mean, it'd be nice to also be able to keep, you know, big part of the industry and the productions in California and make movies. You know, we've got the best crews in LA, and, you know, because of the budgets, we're always forced to go on locations. Like right now, I'm in New Jersey doing a movie that takes place in Chicago. I'm doing the Aaron Sorkin film, the Chicago 7 trial. You know, turns out it's actually more expensive because we're bringing SAG actors from, you know, New York, and the turnaround and the travel. I mean, it's like all these things. But yeah, I wish, you know, these movies would. And yeah, I think people want him. I mean, I think they want him. They just, I think, you know, if we can get different audiences to go to the theaters and see these kind of films like they are seeing Ford vs. Ferrari, it's going to be number one this weekend. That's great. I think it's surpassing its expectations in terms of box office. You know, that'd be great and encouraging to everyone. So,
well, the movie's awesome, and I'm so happy for your success and the success of the film. It's really great. You guys should absolutely check it out. And I can't thank you enough for being on the show. So thank you so much for coming on.
Oh, my pleasure, Ben. It was very nice talking to you, and hi to everybody who was listening in. I hope you enjoy the film when you see it.
So I want to thank Fade and Papa Michael for coming on the show and sharing his experiences on Ford versus Ferrari and all of his other great projects. We are definitely going to have that guy back because he's a joy to talk to. How about that? You know who else is a joy? Connor Crosby, our producer. You can find him at ignitionvisuals.com. And of course, Matt Russell, our sound guru. He mixes and masters and makes the show sound so smooth and delicious. You can find him at gainstructure.com, gainstructure.com, and at gainstructure on Twitter. While you're on Twitter, why don't you tweet us? Let us know what you think of the show, if you have any guest suggestions. And of course, if you have questions for upcoming guests, you can ask them on all of our social media, Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter, at Go Creative Show. Of course, I want to thank our sponsors, Rule Boston Camera, Hedge, Premium Beat, and Shutterstock. Without these people, the show wouldn't exist. So please support those that support us. And we'll see you guys next week. Bye-bye.